From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a conversation with Secretary of State John Kerry as he looks back on his tenure as America's top diplomat and looks ahead to foreign policy in the Trump administration.
It's really important for leaders of countries to be very clear and careful in the statements they make, because their words are weighed extremely carefully by other countries.
Also today, Boston's biotech leaders gather in San Francisco for a week of deal-making.
There's somewhat of a buoyant mood. I think you're going to see some more acquisitions over the course of the week.
And
all of a sudden, the car experiences mechanical failure and is unable to stop. What should the car do, and who should decide?
Moral machines and decision-making algorithms in self-driving cars. That's next up on Radio Boston. First, the
news. Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In the waning days of his tenure as Secretary of State, John Kerry has been on something of a diplomatic speaking tour. A couple of weeks ago, he issued a dire warning about the prospects for peace in the Middle East. And today, he was in Cambridge talking about America's essential role in climate change.
What we do right now today matters. Because if we don't go far enough, fast enough, the damage we could inflict could take centuries to undo, if it can be undone at all. We don't get a second chance on this one.
Kerry spoke this morning at MIT's Sloan School of Management. Kerry did not mention President-elect Donald Trump by name, but he didn't really have to when he spoke in defense of climate science.
And everybody knows here, especially, that scientists, they don't tell you conjecture, they tell you what the facts are telling them. That's what science is about. That's why we've placed a premium on listening to people who are scientists, at least traditionally.
But of course, we are living in anything but traditional times. Kerry's likely successor, former Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson, is also a highly non-traditional pick to lead the State Department. So with just 11 days to go before his time as Secretary of State comes to an official close, we sat down with John Kerry this morning for an in-depth interview, looking back at his 4 years as America's top diplomat. Big picture here. How are you feeling at the end of your term?
I feel great. I mean, I feel very energized still, very focused, trying to finish up some key things, regretting a little bit that there isn't more time to try to finish the unfinished business, but very proud of the things that we've accomplished.
Well, tell me more about the regret part.
Well, you know, we should focus more on the things we've accomplished, but I mean, obviously, Syria disturbs me greatly, and I'm not happy with where Syria is. I think what I've achieved is, by leading the formation of the International Syria Support Group and passing resolutions at the UN and getting the communiques we got, we have created a framework for resolving it. But that framework has yet to be implemented, and it's deeply disturbing to me that so much violence has continued with the world kind of not able to pull the parties to the table yet. But when it happens, it will happen along the lines of what we put together. Ukraine obviously continues to be a concern, and there are a lot of reasons for why that hasn't been able to progress more, which I'll talk about when I'm out. But I feel very proud of the fact that we got a nuclear weapon potential away from a country with whom we haven't talked for 35 years, Iran, and we were able to reach an agreement under very difficult circumstances, but it's a sound agreement, it's solid, it's working. The world is safer because of this agreement. Iran cannot possibly make a nuclear weapon during this period of time, I feel very confident about that. I'm very proud of what we did on climate change with the Paris Agreement, and the oceans work we have done has been groundbreaking. That's a strange way to say oceans, but oceans parting. But what it's been able to do is awaken people to the fact that the oceans themselves are threatened, and life itself, therefore, on the planet is threatened because of it. So there's a lot of work we've done. I say to people, we have been the United States of America has been more engaged in more places in the world on more simultaneous crises, but engaged with positive consequence, more so than at any time in American history.
Are you concerned that that's going to get reversed soon?
Well, I'm concerned about, sure, everybody has a lot of questions about where things are going. We just don't know. But I'm not going to put my energy into focusing on things that are hypothetical and that we don't know. So I'm just going to keep moving until we cross the finish line, and then I'll focus on where we are.
Well, let me ask you a couple quick questions about climate. During a press conference just last week, you said, quote, "The science is absolutely irrefutable that the growth in greenhouse gas emissions is a dire threat to which we have to respond." And you're here today at the MIT Sloan School to give a talk, another speech on climate change. I'm just curious about whether or not you're bothered or disturbed, or how much you're bothered disturbed that you find yourself in 2017 still having to defend the science of climate change.
Well, it is disturbing that there is a genuine minority getting smaller all the time that doesn't still accept the basic science. But it is affirming that many, many, many more people are now accepting it. It's not the kind of debate it was. So, yes, we have to continue to push it with some people. And unfortunately now, evidently, with a president-elect of the United States who has evidenced his own skepticism about it. And that poses potential serious risks to all of us in this endeavor. But I believe the American people and the people in the planet are deeply committed to this. They understand what is happening. Cities and mayors and governors and states and 196 nations came together in Paris, and one nation being skeptical by its leadership is not going to stop all the rest of them from moving. But it's not necessarily going to empower us to move as fast as we need to, which is part of my discussion today. And that's concerning.
Yeah. So given the time we have, I would love to be able to talk with you more about climate overall, but I want to...
Well, when I'm out and we finish up, I'm happy to come in and we'll do a longer session.
Let's do that. Sure. But a couple of weeks ago, you gave that speech about Mideast peace and the threats to Mideast peace. And I just wanted to ask you briefly what your reaction was to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's reaction to your speech when he said he didn't feel like Israel should be getting lectured about peace in the Middle East.
Well, I'm not going to get into characterizing the Prime Minister or his comments. It's just not productive. I spoke out of affection and concern for a country I love, Israel. I supported Israel 100% as a senator for 28 years, and I've supported it 100% as a Secretary of State, and we have stopped every resolution that was harmful or piling on or delegitimizing or singling out Israel with UNESCO, with the Human Rights Commission, with the UN. We've been there for Israel every step of the way. And I spoke out of my concern that if you want to be a Jewish state and you want to remain a democracy, you have to have a two-state solution. And what is happening is policy in Israel is being driven by the settlers who don't support a two-state solution, who want their settlements to prevent the possibility of two states.
America's next ambassador, his personal opinion is in line with those settlers.
That's accurate. He has personally expressed that opinion, and he has a hearing coming up, and we'll see what he says about it. But the fact is, you literally, by definition, cannot have a Jewish state and a democratic state and have a whole bunch of Palestinians in it who are living under military rule while the rest of the country is living under civil rule, and they have different rights and different, you know, it's just not a democracy. And if you don't have two states, you have one state, already the non-Jewish population outnumbers the Jewish population in one state. So somebody, all I did was ask questions. How does this work? Tell me, is the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, going to patrol all the communities of the West Bank forever? What happens with schools? What happens with businesses? And so I do think that it's important for Israel to have a debate about this, and that's what that speech has helped to foster.
So I was thinking back to, many decades ago, your testimony on Capitol Hill about Vietnam, the testimony that really put you on the national stage. You were driven by conscience to say what you said then. And I wonder, and that's been sort of a major part of your career in political service since then. Am I hearing correctly that your conscience is demanding you to, you know, you made the speech about the Middle East a couple weeks ago, you're speaking about climate change today. I mean, as you're looking at the last couple of weeks of your tenure as Secretary of State, is there something more than just policy driving you to speak this way now?
You know, I came into public life during the 1960s when a whole bunch of us believed in our ability to change the world. And we did a lot of things. I was part of the environment movement, part of the women's movement. We had the Equal Rights Amendment. We helped set the country on a course to change its relationship with 50% of our country, with women. I was part of the peace effort to try to end the war in Vietnam, to put us on a different track. As a public person, I've always tried to reflect what is embodied in our defining ideals as a nation about equality and fairness and justice and so forth. And I think that for many of us, the years of the Civil Rights Movement, Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy running for president in 1968, and the war and so forth, these were defining moments in terms of trying to hold government accountable and have a level of responsibility and truth-telling. I mean, you can't have responsibility and you can't have us living up to our ideals unless it's based on a fairly common acceptance of truth, of what is true, what is the truth here. And I think that too much, to a greater degree than is anywhere near appropriate, our country and our politics are being governed by more and more powerful interests, by fewer and fewer people. In the sense of the amount of money that has controlled access and other kinds of things. Now, that has changed a little bit
yeah.
with the last few years with the new platforms that exist in communications. But it is not proving to be fact-based communication. And that's disturbing. And we have a new phenomenon of fake news and of all kinds of interventions in that communication process. So we still have a lot of work to do to protect our own democracy. And I'm motivated by my passion for our basic values, our protecting our interests, and for protecting the future.
Well, since you said that, let me ask you, can one do foreign policy or diplomacy via tweet or Twitter?
No, obviously. I think that's a concern, and it's been expressed by a lot of people. I'm not going to get into that debate right now, but I do think that it's really important for leaders of countries to be very clear and careful in the statements they make, because their words are weighed extremely carefully by other countries. And you have to create a continuity of seriousness and of credibility in order to be able to be taken seriously and get things done.
I'm going to guess that you may not choose to answer this, but are you already getting the sense that America is losing its credibility in the eyes of foreign leaders because of some of the things that the president-elect has tweeted?
I'm not going to comment on the president-elect. You appropriately defined that. I will say that before this race, in the last years, just the fact that we can't pass budgets in our Congress, just the fact that we are gridlocked in our own democracy, the fact that everybody who travels can see that we're not investing in our airports, in our rail, in our infrastructure, and so forth, people are noticing a United States that is not getting the job done in some ways. And I think that has affected, I've noticed it in the 4 years I've been secretary, I think that our own crisis of democracy is in its own way affecting our ability to leverage in the same way that we used to in the world.
What's the consequence of that?
Well, I think the United States is still the indispensable force for positive change and for rule of law and for order and structure. I mean, when Ebola happened, the United States stepped up and led the charge in order to prevent Ebola from taking hundreds of thousands of lives. AIDS, we are the country that has now created a moment where we have the first generation of children that may be born AIDS-free. We are the one that has led the effort to strengthen NATO and strengthen the frontline states against Russia's pressures. There's so many places and ways in which our leadership on refugees, we're the largest donor in the world to the refugees from Syria. I can run down a long list of things where if the United States isn't stepping up, I don't say this arrogantly at all, we're in a position to do this. We're the most powerful economy in the world. We're an $18 trillion economy. And so we have an ability to try to make some things happen that other countries don't necessarily have. And what we need to do is respect that incredible blessing that we have as a nation and make sure that we are leading in the best ways possible. And in the last years, with the politicization of everything and the gridlock that has been a purposeful political strategy for political gain by one party, not for nation, but for one party, that is discernible by everybody in the world, and it is not helping us.
Well, Secretary John Kerry, thank you so very much for speaking with us today.
Glad to be with you.
And we spoke with the Secretary of State earlier today at MIT's Sloan School of Management. Back in a moment, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. When Boston's Colonial Theater opened in 1900, performers such as Ethel Merman, Fred Astaire, Vivian Leigh, Noel Coward, and Katharine Hepburn all took the stage there. It was long seen as a testing ground for Broadway shows before they went to New York. But faced with millions of dollars in renovations and maintenance, the Colonial closed its doors in September of 2015. Now, there's a new deal to reopen the theater. Emerson College still owns the Colonial, but it's got a new operator, the Ambassador Theater Group, a UK-based theater company that runs more than 40 theater venues around the world. Here's Emerson President Lee Pelton talking about the deal today.
This is a unique and game-changing relation for us and for ATG. So it provides our students with an unparalleled access to world-class theater.
Well, joining us now with more is Jeremy Goodwin. He's contributor to WBUR's The Artery. He's also a member of the Boston Theater Critics Association. Jeremy, it's great to have you back.
Good afternoon.
So we talked a little bit about the Colonial's earliest days here, but remind us, what was the importance of the theater to Boston's theater scene just before it closed?
Sure. Yeah, to understand the stakes here, you really have to understand the importance of the Colonial to Boston theater history and really to American theater history. And you went through some of those greatest hits. It opened in 1900. With a production of Ben-Hur that famously had eight horses on stage. It kind of went on from there.
Okay.
But they don't make them like that anymore is the kind of impression you get when you go there. It's a palace of theater. There's some 5,000 square feet of gold leaf. There's intricate murals. Katharine Hepburn famously loved the working fireplace in the ladies' lounge. The fireplace wasn't on the last time I was there, but this is the kind of place where, you know, the ladies' room is much nicer than my apartment.
Yeah.
You know, it's a palace. It's a palace of theater.
So yeah, it was a jewel. It was really a jewel of the theater scene in its day. But tell us about this new deal then. So the Ambassador Theater Group, right? UK based, operates 40 venues around the country. What are they likely to bring to the Colonial as its new operator?
They are a growing player with a growing footprint in the United States. As you mentioned, most of their holdings are in the UK. Just in the past 2 years or so, they've acquired two Broadway houses, five other theaters around the United States, and they are looking to be big players. They just announced last month that they won a bidding war to bring the Harry Potter musical to Broadway in one of their venues when it migrates over from the West End next year. This spring, they'll have Sunday in the Park with George with Jake Gyllenhaal, one of the big attractions of the season at one of their theaters. So they're really looking to make a splash.
Okay, so let me ask you about that, though. A Broadway-type splash is one thing. Definitely can fill the seats, sell tickets. But what might that mean? Do they want to do that here in at the Colonial in Boston? And what would that mean for the local theaters?
Well, what they can do is build a pipeline of talent and send it here, because they are known to invest in shows in the West End and in Broadway, but also in touring productions. They, for instance, are one of the major producers of Jersey Boys, which was brought to Boston just a few months ago by another commercial presenter in the city, Broadway in Boston. So what they can do is actually develop shows and then send them on the road to their venues, mm-hmm. including Boston.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk a little bit about the circumstances which led to the Colonial closing in September 2015. The Boston Globe back then had an article in which they wrote that, quote, with an abundance of other downtown venues, including the Boston Opera House, City Wang Theater, City Schubert, not to mention the Calderwood Pavilion at the Boston Center for the Arts in the South End, basically listing all those names. And then they asked the question, does Boston have more larger theater spaces than it needs? That question still sort of looms over the Colonial, doesn't it?
Yeah, Boston was starting to have that conversation about how many houses, how many seats can it really support in the current market? And then Boston University said they wanted to sell the BU Theater, where the Huntington Theater Company operates. Emerson said, we're not really sure what we're going to do with the Colonial. Suddenly everyone stood up and said, well, not these two theaters. Let us keep these ones. Don't take these away. But the questions still remain. The conversation lately has been less about building these great palaces of theater and dealing with the needs of the smaller groups in the city, whether they be theater companies or dance companies. And the conversation lately has been more about the difficulty they have finding space in the city to perform and to rehearse. So are the Colonial theaters and the Wang theaters of the world really serving the needs of today's market? It's an open question. Mm.
Well, I'm still thinking about what you said about Katharine Hepburn and the fireplace yeah. and the ladies' lounge. I mean, do you think that Boston could once again be known as a pre-Broadway city now that, you know, this venue is opening again? Yeah.
That's a model that a lot of people have a lot of nostalgia for, and they love to tell stories about Stephen Sondheim bringing the first productions of Follies to Boston. If I can squeeze in a story about Rodgers and Hammerstein, they had a musical themed in the West called Away We Go that they were premiering at Boston before bringing to Broadway. And they realized they needed a new number for the show. And they assembled the cast on the stairs of the lobby and taught them a new song. It was called Oklahoma. It caught on. They named the show after it, and they played it that night. They performed it that night after learning it in the lobby of the Colonial Theater. So these are these great stories. But is the Ambassador Theater Group coming in going to revive that model? No, I don't think so. But if they are bringing high-profile shows to Boston, making a go of it over the course of this 40-year lease and investing millions of dollars in infrastructure improvements as they are, that's good for everyone in Boston, I think.
One last question in the couple seconds that we have. We heard Emerson President Lee Pelton in that piece mm-hmm. of tape at the top of our conversation. I mean, do you agree with him? Is this going to provide some opportunities for students at Emerson?
Sure. If you're a theater goer in Boston, if you're a student in Emerson, I think this is a day where you're breathing a sigh of relief. A, this theater is going to remain. That wasn't at all clear. It has been dark for over a year. It had been dark for a year previous to the last run of shows before that. So it's been flickering on and off. Here's a company coming in saying Emerson has committed $1 million to get it up to shape before Ambassador gets here. Then the Ambassador Group is going to spend $1 million and then maintain a maintenance fund of about another $10 million over the course of their 40-year lease. So people are making an investment here. They're putting stakes down. And if that venue is a going concern and has shows happening in Boston, I think that's good for everybody.
Well, Jeremy Goodwin is a contributor to WBUR's The Artery. He's also a member of the Boston Theater Critics Association. Really great to talk with you, Jeremy. Thanks so much.
And if they can bring 8 horses on stage for the next production, that'd be fun, too.
Let's see if we can put even one horse into our Radio Boston studio.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Jeremy. Well, it is Monday, so let's check in on the world of health and medicine with Carrie Goldberg. She's host of WBUR's Common Health Blog. And Carrie, we're doing something a bit different today. We're not going to bring you just one story. We've got, what, 3?
We have 3. It's the Common Health Roundup of need-to-know news. And I'm thinking that we could start with today marking the opening of the biggest biotech conference of the year, the J.P. Morgan Healthcare Conference in San Francisco, that brings together more than 9,000 biotech folk.
8,999 of them are from Boston, right? Okay, just kidding. Like, not that many. But Boston is considered, widely considered, the home of the biggest biotech cluster in the country, if not the world.
That's right. And a lot of it centered in Kendall Square in Cambridge, where a sandwich these days costs $12. And also elsewhere as well. So there's this big annual migration of our biotech folk to the West Coast each year for JPM, the JP Morgan Conference. And it's kind of a good moment to take the pulse of the industry.
Okay, so how is it looking in biotech? Quickening pulse? Flatlining?
Definitely not flatlining, no. But last year actually was not such a great one for biotech. You know, the IPOs, the initial public offerings, were down, way down. And venture capital investment totaled about $6.5 billion, which was down from more than $10 billion the year before. The NASDAQ biotech index fell by about 20% last year. So you put it all together, and the headline in the online publication Stat is, chastened by a rough year, biotech tiptoes into its annual batch.
So less exuberance, in other words.
Less exuberance, though. Exuberance is scary, right? Because it might be irrational.
Yes.
But there's also a lot of uncertainty about what the Trump administration will do, but also some relief in the industry because there had been concern that a Hillary Clinton victory could mean much tougher efforts to control drug prices. You know, drug prices have been getting higher and higher in recent years to the point now that a typical new cancer drug costs $100,000 a patient.
Okay, so with Trump administration soon to occupy the White House, maybe that's less of a concern. Will we also perhaps see a pickup in investment in biotech?
Well, we may. I mean, I think the issue of drug prices is far from over.
Yeah.
There could also be a boost from the 21st Century Cures Act that passed recently that aims to make drug approvals by the FDA sort of faster. We've got word from the conference today already that they're already seeing some big deal making, including a deal by the Japanese drug maker Takeda to buy Ariad, which is based in Cambridge and makes a leukemia drug, for about $5 billion.
So that acquisition is a $5 billion acquisition. Got it. Okay. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Any other specific companies from the Boston area to watch?
Well, you know, Biogen, which is the biggest biotech company in the Boston area, just announced it has a new CEO, Michael Vounatsos. And he's said to be there. And Vounatsos was at Merck for many years. He said he wants to replenish Biogen's pipeline, so the drugs that are in development. So it sounds like he's in a buying mood. And I think the JPM conference could be a great place to shop.
So perhaps some M&A activity in biotech. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's your story, your first story of the Common Health Roundup. On to another topic that's happening elsewhere out of state, but means a lot here in Massachusetts, because on Capitol Hill, of course, the battle has been launched over defunding Planned Parenthood.
Yes, it has. Late last week, House Speaker Paul Ryan and other Republican leaders made very clear they're going to be pushing to cut federal funding for Planned Parenthood. They've tried to do that before and failed, but this time around, they've got both houses of Congress and the White House. So I'd say the odds are more in their favor than ever.
Okay, so here in the state, Massachusetts has, what, 5 Planned Parenthood clinics?
Right, 5 clinics. They serve about 30,000 patients a year. Family planning, cancer screening, testing for STIs, sexually transmitted infections, and abortion, which is what makes them so controversial. I spoke with Dr. Jennifer Childs-Roschach. She's the president of the Planned Parenthood League of Massachusetts. And here's the thing. You know, even though Planned Parenthood is controversial because it provides abortions, this defunding wouldn't actually affect abortion because there are already 0 federal dollars that pay for it. Here's Dr. Childs-Roschach.
So the irony here is that the money that potentially could be cut if this goes through is that it's all impacting preventive care and family planning. And we are currently at the lowest rate of abortion, teen pregnancies, and STIs ever.
So the cuts could affect what got us to these low rates, which is better access to better birth control.
Okay, so but give us a sense here about, like, how many people are we talking about who come to Planned Parenthood clinics in Massachusetts for things, services other than abortion?
Well, so here are the numbers. You got 30,000 patients. About 10,000 of them are on MassHealth. That's our version of Medicaid, which is paid for mainly with federal money. So that's the number that could be affected by defunding. And they are coming for not just abortions, but, you know, all kinds of sort of primary care for a gynecology. So mammograms or STI testing or birth control. And, you know, we tend to think of Massachusetts as having plenty of medical care, but this kind of gynecological primary care isn't always so easy to access. So you can say, you know, know, they can just go somewhere else and they can, but it might not be that easy.
And so that's what Planned Parenthood is saying is at risk if they're defunded.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that was story number two. What's your final health story for us today?
So the final story is peanuts, or rather peanut allergies. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, this had been coming for quite a while, but late last week, federal health authorities put their stamp of approval on the new guidelines that say basically to cut the risk of peanut allergy, which is the most dangerous food allergy, feed your baby peanuts early and often.
Okay, but of course not in the form of whole peanuts, no choking.
Right, thank you, Mom. Yeah. Thank you. No whole peanuts. But the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases now recommends that babies be given food with peanut powder in it, or, you know, pureed peanut, before they hit 6 months. And for kids who are at high risk of allergies, like if they have eczema or other signs, possibly even earlier. But all of this, of course, only with a doctor's supervision.
Okay, so let me state the obvious fact here, but it's still worth noting that this is a 180-degree reversal from advice that had been given to parents by doctors for years.
Yes. It is. And tempting as it is to rant about how they shouldn't give us guidelines if they don't really know, the fact is that, you know, science is a work in progress. And when it advances, the guidelines advance too. And in this case, you know, peanut allergies were very much on the rise, despite the advice to hold off on peanuts. And there was some really game-changing research out of Israel, where most kids eat this peanut snack called bamba, and the rates of peanut allergy are dramatically lower. So that was a major clue that led ultimately to this. Mm.
Now, but we should acknowledge, though, that something like 2% of American children have peanut allergies, and some of them are very, very serious. Like,
yes.
Some of those kids have very serious allergies. But, mm-hmm. but Kara, I'm curious, I mean, if we do, if the United States does some kind of version of bamba, could we reduce the rate of peanut allergy?
That is certainly the hope, including, and the federal health authorities say that's what they believe. Personally, I predict supermarket shelves will soon be full of peanut products for infants.
Oh, a new market.
Yep.
To sell to already stressed out parents. Great. Yep. Well, Kara Goldberg is host of WBUR's Common Health blog. You can find a link to all her reporting at our website, theradioboston.org. Kara, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. After 16 hours of deliberation, a federal jury has sentenced convicted killer Gary Lee Sampson to death. This is Sampson's second death penalty. Back in 2003, he pleaded guilty to killing two Massachusetts men and a third man in New Hampshire, and at that time was given the death penalty. However, that original sentence was vacated after a judge found evidence of juror misconduct in Sampson's first trial. WBUR senior reporter David Boeri is at the Moakley Federal Courthouse, and he was there at the handing down of Sampson's death penalty today. He joins us now. Hi there, David.
Hi, Meghna.
So tell us more. Sampson received one death penalty and one life sentence?
So recall that there are two victims in this case in Massachusetts. Jonathan Rizzo, age 19 at the time, Philip McCloskey, aged 69. So today there was essentially a split verdict, and the verdict, the jurors had to decide whether they should impose the death penalty or life in prison without the chance of parole. It was one or the other, a binary decision. And today they decided, they split essentially the verdict regarding the two victims.
I see. So we've got some tape here from U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz, who spoke just after the sentence was handed down. Here she is.
And while we are disappointed in the verdict and the way that it was split, we believe that the verdict that was ultimately rendered with the life sentence and the death penalty, that the death penalty encompassed all of the crimes that he committed.
So U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz there saying that she's happy with the results. But, David, 16 hours of deliberation, is that relatively fast? Was it expected?
The first time around in 2003, the jurors took 11 hours. This is 5 hours longer than that. The jurors had several questions. They clearly, from their verdict form, they looked at it. They had their own characteristic independence, one might say. It seems like they have resolved issues, not always in favor of the government. It's very telling to look at this verdict that they've reached, although it's surprising that they didn't find a death penalty was warranted for the death of Philip McCloskey, who was repeatedly stabbed, according to Sampson's own confession. His head was nearly severed. An elderly man. It seemed to fit heinous, cruel, and indifferent, but they didn't do it.
Hmm.
So, on the other hand, remember, there's only two choices, and the other verdict is life in prison without the chance of parole. And today, Scott McCloskey, the son of Philip McCloskey, said, you know, it still ends up in a verdict of the death penalty. I'm glad it's done because he will die. And in that sense, if this verdict goes through, Sampson will be executed, although not for McCloskey's crimes. But the son said, I'm glad it's done. It's ended up in the right place. God rest my father. God rest in peace.
Right. And members of the family members of the victims had to sit through that entire sentencing trial again, reliving the experience of hearing Sampson himself describe the heinous nature of his crime. So, but let me ask you, David, I'm reading also that there was something a little strange, a strange circumstance in court today. A juror tried to insert a note of some kind into the verdict.
That's right. It's not clear what that note was, but no one knows what's in the note, including the judge. At the end of the day, the jurors were polled individually, and they speak through their verdict. So each one was polled after the verdicts were announced, and each one said, I agree with the verdict. No one used the opportunity to say anything else. So this becomes a matter as much as so much of the testimony in this case will be for future appeals. We know about the death penalty, if we know anything. It is a long process of appeal. And so that's what we're looking for in this particular case.
Well, that's WBUR senior reporter David Boeri speaking to us from the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston. David, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, thought experiment time. Cast your mind into the very near future. Self-driving cars are everywhere on the streets of Boston. The upside? There's a lot less honking and no one making left-hand turns from the right-hand lane without a turn signal anymore. But the downside? A computer is now making decisions about who lives and who dies. Well, what do I mean? Here's an example. Say the car's brakes suddenly fail. You're in a self-driving car and the brakes suddenly fail. And right at that time, it also just happens that a bunch of students jaywalk across the street. Should the car swerve to save all of the students, but maybe kill you? Or should it plow through the students, but leave you in the car unharmed? Well, that is a moral dilemma that will soon have to be solved millions of times a day by machines, which is why MIT's Media Lab has set up a website and experiment that is crowdsourcing how humans make these moral decisions to inform how we program future autonomous vehicles. The website is called The Moral Machine, and we've got a link to it at radioboston.org. Iyad Rahman is a professor at MIT's Media Lab, and he's co-creator of this research, and he joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so first of all, explain to us, when we say moral machine or the moral machine, what exactly do we mean? What are you asking?
Well, we are saying that very soon machines run by computer programs will make decisions that have life or death consequences to individuals. And it will not happen in a small controlled environment like a factory. It will happen in urban environments at a very large scale. And I think this brings up very interesting questions pertaining to the trust of the public in these systems. Mm-hmm. So we're interested in understanding what is it that the public are concerned about when they think of cars driving around, pieces of metal in our urban in cities. And I think it's a very good question. It's very pertinent to ask this question before we adopt such technology.
Right. And so you're going about basically through the Moral Machine website, you're asking people to take a test that provides a variety of scenarios, right? And they're relatively simple scenarios. An autonomous vehicle has a brake failure most of the time, mm-hmm. and the car has to decide whether to swerve or whether to continue ahead. And the difference in each one of the scenarios is who the potential victims could be, right?
That's right. So basically, if you think about real-life accidents, obviously they're extremely complex things. There aren't two options. You know, the car doesn't have to decide between just swerving or staying on course. It often, you know, has a bunch of options possible, and it's making very complex calculations with uncertain outcomes. But we wanted to simplify matters so that normal people can engage with these questions and basically give us their opinion. So sometimes we put the trade-off between people in the car and people on the road. Other times it's two groups of pedestrians that you might hit either by going forward or swerving into another group of pedestrians. And we vary all sorts of things like their ages and their numbers and their genders and so on.
Well, I mean, there's interesting things like homeless versus a professional. You throw in the size of a person, a quote-unquote large man sometimes.
I mean, what we're trying to do here is obviously we would never take these what people say and suggest this to be programmed into the cars directly. You know, I don't think we should crowdsource or take a public opinion poll on whose life matters more. But I think what we're trying to do is confront people with the difficulty of those choices, and that if they think that none of these things should matter, then we would like to know that, and we'd like to give them the opportunity to express this.
Hmm. So you've you've had several million people so far take the Moral Machines scenario test. And what are you beginning to find in terms of what people say they'd prefer in the behavior, if I could put it that way, of an autonomous vehicle?
Well, I think we're still at an early stage of analyzing the data, but we do have more than 22 million individual decisions now from people from over 160 countries. So this is one of the largest ethical surveys ever done in history, which was kind of a surprise for us. But we're beginning to learn some interesting things. One of them is that people by and large agree that you should minimize total harm. That's a good thing to do. That if you could swerve, for example, even if you harm the person in the car, if that leads to fewer deaths, that's what the car should do. But what we're also learning is that if people imagine themselves in the car, then they would disagree with that.
Oh, so are you saying you found out that human beings are morally inconsistent? Is that what we're saying?
That's right. And of course, this is not a surprise, but I think it does highlight to people that this is something we have to work out as a society together.
Well, so this is I use a joking tone, but this is a very serious, one of the very serious early conclusions that you found, that while you say that people would like to see a car on the road that reduces total harm, they're also telling at the same time they're not likely to buy that kind of car because as a passenger, reducing total harm means that they actually might end up being harmed inside the car. So what does that mean for developers and sellers of future autonomous vehicles?
Well, I think what it means is that the problem is not straightforward. So it's not something that we should leave to a programmer or an engineer, because they're simply not trained to think about these problems. These problems are legislative problems. They are problems of the design of the social contract, how we all get along and balance different priorities. You know, if you think about it, we already face these questions. When we set a speed limit, we are reducing the convenience for some people who are going to get home a little bit later. But in exchange, we're going to increase public safety. And we can increase public safety even more by banning cars completely, but we don't do that either. So I think as a society, we somehow navigate these things and find a balance between the interests of different stakeholders, and we need to have a similar conversation here.
Well, do you anticipate that some of the answers or trends might change the more detail and variability you put into the questions themselves? And I say that, like, let me give you an example. Like right now in the Moral Machine website, in either scenario, in every scenario, either choice, someone dies, right? But in truth, in automobiles, most time people would be wearing seatbelts, they have airbags, etc. So perhaps in some cases the person in the car is just safer, their risk is lower. So do you think you'd get different answers if you started introducing those shades of granularity in terms of the types of scenarios you could see?
I agree. Yeah, I do think so. So I think that obviously we are trying to be a little provocative by forcing a choice here. I think in the real world, things are going to be risk assessments with a lot of uncertainty. So the choice could be you might slightly increase the risk to the passenger, but you would significantly reduce risk to the pedestrians. Should you do that or not? Well, it depends on how big that risk is. And the calculation becomes more nuanced. But I think the fact remains that it is a trade-off. Mm. So what is it? Is it injury for one person versus, you know, or for five people versus a death of one person? How do you actually account for these things? And how do you observe afterwards as a, you know, if you're a regulator, how do you actually check that a particular car maker is abiding by whatever it is that society has decided is acceptable?
Right. I mean, so Mercedes-Benz a while ago had said that initially, a high ranking person at Mercedes-Benz, correct me if I'm wrong, said that you know, we know that there's at least one person that you can save in every autonomous vehicle, and that's a passenger or a driver. So the car should should make decisions to privilege the people in the car.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, the person was, I mean, a little bit sort of pushed to make that call on the spot and said something to the effect that if you are certain you could save the person in the car, then you should do so. But Mercedes subsequently withdrew that statement and clarified that, you know, they would want to do what is legal and what is socially acceptable. Now, what is socially acceptable is something we still don't know, and this is what I'm hoping that we could achieve with surveys like the ones we're running.
Yeah. So let me ask you, so on that point, there's some very big overarching questions here when we're talking about morality in machines of any kinds, but especially with self-driving cars, because we are going to see many of them on the roads in the not-too-distant future. I mean, right now we've been having a conversation that presupposes that human moral codes are the ones that we should follow. But shouldn't we be taking the opportunity to maybe making cars even more moral than human beings are?
Well, I think if we can, yes, we should. And here is how it works. I think, first of all, technologists predict that these cars will increase safety full stop, you know, will eliminate up to 90% of accidents. So from my perspective, I think we should adopt them as soon as we can. And we should make sure that our inability to make a good call on very unusual, rare situations like a dilemma should not prevent us from adopting the safer technology that would ultimately save many more lives. Mm. So that's the first thing. But the second point, which responds to your question, is that nowadays, if we are faced with this situation as human drivers, we simply cannot make that choice. We are too slow, essentially, and we're going to use our gut feeling and act in some random fashion. And we decided also not to blame people for these things because it is an accident. That's why we call it an accident. But as technology becomes more reliable and cars can make those judgments fast enough, then in a way, it's creating a new moral imperative for us to design things more thoughtfully.
Oh, so I've been wrestling with something all day here, and that is, you know, in common parlance, when we talk about morality, we tend to use very black and white language, moral absolutes, moral codes. But of course, in truth, as you were talking about earlier, there are many circumstances surrounding each moral decision that human beings themselves make as individuals. But by virtue of trying to program a moral sensibility into a machine, aren't we? We are actually trying to codify an amorphous thing into a set of rules, right? And aren't we trying to essentially do the impossible?
In a way, but in a way, it's the ultimate challenge for humanity, because once you are asked to describe it in such detail that a machine can follow these rules, then you can no longer hide behind ambiguity or sort of hope that fate will decide things somehow through a flip of a coin. You have to make a call. You have to program things in a particular way. So in a way, I think by thinking about how to program artificial intelligence to make life or death decisions, we're learning something about ourselves and our own morality.
Hmm. Now, ultimately, when it comes to the regulations that will emerge surrounding these cars, I mean, your research also found that that it seemed as if Americans were somewhat resistant to the government making decisions on how these cars, or sort of the moral rules that these cars follow?
Well, I think what our survey found is that if the government forced all cars to minimize total harm, which means that in some circumstances, very rare circumstances, it may sacrifice you, people wouldn't buy them. And I think that's a typical conflict between our individual self-interest and the public good, which is in this case safety.
But also, it's not a great idea, I think, for the car companies to be making these decisions, right?
Exactly. I think somebody has to make those decisions, and I think it's better that we talk about it rather than assume the problem away and that some programmer somewhere will make the right call. So for me, I would rather discuss the issue in public and engage the public and giving them a voice, essentially in this debate, not necessarily a final voice, but a voice that informs legislators and thoughtful and trustworthy people in our community.
And this needs to happen now, right? Because the technology is coming. So what's the next step in your research?
Well, the next step now is for us to understand, to study the data that we've collected. And one of the interesting things that we're beginning to find is that there are cultural differences. So if you recall, we've collected data from 160 countries, and they're not all the same. Some countries care more about think the car has an obligation to its owner more than other countries. And I will not comment yet on details until we've conducted the analysis, but I'm very excited to look into it.
The cultural complications of moral absolutes. Wow. Well, Iyad Rawan is a associate professor at MIT's Media Lab, where he's part of the team behind MIT's Moral Machine, a crowdsourcing project on the moral decisions made by machines. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.